and none came over to provide public displays of affection. He stared without blinking at Scully, who would remember Steve's look of contempt years later. "It's unyielding," Scully recalled, "like an X-ray boring inside your bones, down to where you're soft and destructively mortal." For a moment, standing on stage while pretending not to notice Jobs, Scully thought back to a friendly trip they had taken a year earlier to Cambridge, Massachusetts, to visit Jobs's hero, Edwin Land. He had been dethroned from the company he created, Polaroid, and Jobs had said to Scully in disgust, all he did was blow a lousy few million, and they took his company away from him. Now, Scully reflected, he was taking Jobs's company away from him. As Scully went over the organizational chart, he introduced Gasset as the new head of a combined Macintosh and Apple II product group. On the chart was a small box labeled Chairman, with no lines connecting to it, not to Scully or to anyone else. Scully briefly noted that in that role, Jobs would play the part of global visionary. But he didn't acknowledge Jobs' presence. There was a smattering of awkward applause. Jobs stayed home for the next few days, blinds drawn, his answering machine on, seeing only his girlfriend, Tina Redsea. For hours on end, he sat there playing his Bob Dylan tapes, especially The Times They Are a-Changin'. He had recited the second verse the day he unveiled the Macintosh to the Apple shareholders, 16 months earlier. That verse ended nicely, "For the loser now will be later to win." A rescue squad from his former Macintosh posse arrived to dispel the gloom on Sunday night, led by Andy Hertzfeld and Bill Atkinson. Jobs took a while to answer their knock, and then he led them to a room next to the kitchen that was one of the few places with any furniture. With Redsea's help, he served some vegetarian food he had ordered. "So what really happened?" Hertzfeld asked. "Is it really as bad as it looks?"
"No, it's worse," Jobs grimaced. "It's much worse than you can imagine."
He blamed Scully for betraying him and said that Apple would not be able to manage without him. His chairman's role, he complained, was completely ceremonial. He was being ejected from his Bandley 3 office to a small and almost empty building he nicknamed Siberia. Hertzfeld turned the topic to happier days, and they began to reminisce about the past. Earlier that week, Dylan had released a new album, Empire Burlesque, and Hertzfeld brought a copy that they played on Jobs's high-tech turntable. The most notable track, When the Night Comes Falling from the Sky, with its apocalyptic message, seemed appropriate for the evening, but Jobs didn't like it. It sounded almost disco, and he gloomily argued that Dylan had been going downhill since Blood on the Tracks. So Hertzfeld moved the needle to the last song on the album, Dark Eyes, which was a simple acoustic number featuring Dylan alone on guitar and harmonica. It was slow and mournful, and Hertzfeld hoped would remind Jobs of the earlier Dylan tracks he so loved. But Jobs didn't like that song either and had no desire to hear the rest of the album. Jobs's overwrought reaction was understandable. Scully had once been a father figure to him. So had Mike Markola. So had Arthur Rock. That week, all three had abandoned him. It gets back to the deep feeling of being rejected at an early age, his friend and lawyer George Riley later said. It's a deep part of his own mythology, and it defines to himself who he is. Jobs recalled years later, "I felt like I'd been punched, the air knocked out of me, and I couldn't breathe." Losing the support of Arthur Rock was especially painful. "Arthur had been like a father to me," Jobs said. "He took me under wing." Rock had taught him about opera, and he and his wife, Tony, had been his hosts in San Francisco and Aspen. "I remember driving into San Francisco one time, and I said to him, 'God, that Bank of America building is ugly.' And he said, 'No, it's the best.
and he proceeded to lecture me, and he was right, of course. Years later, Jobs' eyes welled with tears as he recounted the story. He chose Scully over me. That really threw me for a loop. I never thought he would abandon me. Making matters worse was that his beloved company was now in the hands of a man he considered a bozo. The board felt that I couldn't run a company, and that was their decision to make, he said. But they made one mistake. They should have separated the decision of what to do with me and what to do with Scully. They should have fired Scully, even if they didn't think I was ready to run Apple. Even as his personal gloom slowly lifted, his anger at Scully, his feeling of betrayal deepened. The situation worsened when Scully told a group of analysts that he considered Jobs irrelevant to the company despite his title as chairman. From an operations standpoint, there is no role either today or in the future for Steve Jobs, he said. I don't know what he'll do. The blunt comment shocked the group, and a gasp went through the auditorium. Perhaps getting away to Europe would help, Jobs thought. So in June, he went to Paris, where he spoke at an Apple event and went to a dinner honoring Vice President George H.W. Bush. From there he went to Italy, where he drove the hills of Tuscany with Redzi and bought a bike so he could spend time riding by himself. In Florence, he soaked in the architecture of the city and the texture of the building materials. Particularly memorable were the paving stones, which came from Il Cassone quarry near the Tuscan town of Firenzuola. They were a calming bluish-gray. 20 years later, he would decide that the floors of most major Apple stores would be made of this sandstone. The Apple II was just going on sale in Russia, so Jobs headed off to Moscow, where he met up with Al Eisenstadt. Because there was a problem getting Washington's approval for some of the required export licenses, they visited the commercial attaché at the American Embassy in Moscow, Mike Merwin. He warned them that there were strict laws against sharing technology with the Soviets. Jobs was annoyed. At the Paris trade show, Vice President Bush had encouraged him to get computers into Russia in order to foment revolution from below. Over dinner at a Georgian restaurant that specialized in shish kebab, Jobs continued his rant. How could you suggest this violates American law when it so obviously benefits our interests? He asked Merwin. By putting Macs in the hands of Russians, they could print all their newspapers. Jobs also showed his feisty side in Moscow by insisting on talking about Trotsky, the charismatic revolutionary who fell out of favor and was ordered assassinated by Stalin. At one point, the KGB agent assigned to him suggested he tone down his fervor. You don't want to talk about Trotsky, he said. Our historians have studied the situation, and we don't believe he's a great man anymore. That didn't help. When they got to the State University in Moscow to speak to computer students, Jobs began his speech by praising Trotsky. He was a revolutionary Jobs could identify with. Jobs and Eisenstadt attended the July 4th party at the American Embassy, and in his thank you letter to Ambassador Arthur Hartman, Eisenstadt noted that Jobs planned to pursue Apple's ventures in Russia more vigorously in the coming year. We are tentatively planning on returning to Moscow in September. For a moment, it looked as if Scully's hope that Jobs would turn into a global visionary for the company might come to pass. But it was not to be. Something much different was in store for September. Chapter 18. Next. Prometheus Unbound. The Pirates Abandon Ship. Upon his return from Europe in August 1985, while he was casting about for what to do next, Jobs called the Stanford biochemist Paul Berg to discuss the advances that were being made in gene splicing and recombinant DNA.
Berg described how difficult it was to do experiments in a biology lab, where it could take weeks to nurture an experiment and get a result. "Why don't you simulate them on a computer?" Jobs asked. Berg replied that computers with such capacities were too expensive for university labs. Suddenly, he was excited about the possibilities, Berg recalled. He had it in his mind to start a new company. He was young and rich and had to find something to do with the rest of his life. Jobs had already been canvassing academics to ask what their workstation needs were. It was something he had been interested in since 1983, when he had visited the computer science department at Brown to show off the Macintosh, only to be told that it would take a far more powerful machine to do anything useful in a university lab. The dream of academic researchers was to have a workstation that was both powerful and personal. As head of the Macintosh division, Jobs had launched a project to build such a machine, which was dubbed the Big Mac. It would have a Unix operating system, but with a friendly Macintosh interface. But after Jobs was ousted from the Macintosh division, his replacement, Jean-Louis Gasset, canceled the Big Mac. When that happened, Jobs got a distressed call from Rich Page, who had been engineering the Big Mac's chipset. It was the latest in a series of conversations that Jobs was having with disgruntled Apple employees, urging him to start a new company and rescue them. Plans to do so began to gel over Labor Day weekend, when Jobs spoke to Bud Tribble, the original Macintosh software chief, and floated the idea of starting a company to build a powerful but personal workstation. He also enlisted two other Macintosh division employees who had been talking about leaving, the engineer George Crow and the controller Susan Barnes. That left one key vacancy on the team, a person who could market the new product to universities. The obvious candidate was Daniel Lewin, who at Apple had organized a consortium of universities to buy Macintosh computers in bulk. Besides missing two letters in his first name, Lewin had the chiseled good looks of Clark Kent and a Princetonian's polish. He and Jobs shared a bond. Lewin had written a Princeton thesis on Bob Dylan and charismatic leadership, and Jobs knew something about both of those topics. Lewin's university consortium had been a godsend to the Macintosh group, but he had become frustrated after Jobs left, and Bill Campbell had reorganized marketing in a way that reduced the role of direct sales to universities. He had been meaning to call Jobs when, that Labor Day weekend, Jobs called first. He drove to Jobs's unfurnished mansion, and they walked the grounds while discussing the possibility of creating a new company. Lewin was excited, but not ready to commit. He was going to Austin with Campbell the following week, and he wanted to wait until then to decide. Upon his return, he gave his answer. He was in. The news came just in time for the September 13th Apple board meeting. Although Jobs was still nominally the board's chairman, he had not been to any meetings since he lost power. He called Scully, said he was going to attend, and asked that an item be added to the end of the agenda for a chairman's report. He didn't say what it was about, and Scully assumed it would be a criticism of the latest reorganization. Instead, when his turn came to speak, Jobs described to the board his plans to start a new company. "I've been thinking a lot, and it's time for me to get on with my life," he began. "It's obvious that I've got to do something. I'm 30 years old." Then he referred to some prepared notes to describe his plan to create a computer for the higher education market. The new company would not be competitive with Apple, he promised, and he would take with him only a handful of non-key personnel. He offered to resign as chairman of Apple, but he expressed hope that they could work together. Perhaps Apple would want to buy the distribution rights to his product, he suggested, or license Macintosh software to it. Mike Markola rankled at the possibility that Jobs would hire anyone from Apple. "Why would you take anyone at all?" he asked. "Don't get upset," Jobs assured him and the rest of the board. "These are very low-level people that you won't miss, and they will be leaving anyway." The board initially seemed disposed to wish Jobs well in his venture. After a private discussion, the directors even proposed that Apple take a 10% stake in the new company and that Jobs remain on the board. That night, Jobs and his five renegades met again at his house for dinner. He was in favor of taking the Apple investment, but the others convinced him it was unwise. They also agreed that it would be best if they resigned all at once, right away. Then they could make a clean break. So Jobs wrote a formal letter telling Scully the names of the five who would be leaving, signed it in his spidery lowercase signature, and drove to Apple the next morning to hand it to him before his 7:30 staff meeting.
"Steve, these are not low-level people," Scully said.
"Well, these people were going to resign anyway," Jobs replied. "They are going to be handing in their resignations by 9 this morning." From Jobs' perspective, he had been honest. The five were not division managers or members of Scully's top team. They had all felt diminished, in fact, by the company's new organization. But from Scully's perspective, these were important players. Page was an Apple fellow, and Lewin was a key to the higher education market. In addition, they knew about the plans for Big Mac. Even though it had been shelved, this was still proprietary information. Nevertheless, Scully was sanguine. Instead of pushing the point, he asked Jobs to remain on the board. Jobs replied that he would think about it. But when Scully walked into his 7:30 staff meeting and told his top lieutenants who was leaving, there was an uproar. Most of them felt that Jobs had breached his duties as chairman and displayed stunning disloyalty to the company. "We should expose him for the fraud that he is so that people here stop regarding him as a messiah," Campbell shouted, according to Scully. Campbell admitted that although he later became a great Jobs defender and supportive board member, he was ballistic that morning. "I was fucking furious, especially about him taking Daniel Lewin," he recalled. "Daniel had built the relationships with the universities. He was always muttering about how hard it was to work with Steve, and then he left." Campbell was so angry that he walked out of the meeting to call Lewin at home. When his wife said he was in the shower, Campbell said, "I'll wait." A few minutes later, when she said he was still in the shower, Campbell again said, "I'll wait." When Lewin finally came on the phone, Campbell asked him if it was true. Lewin acknowledged it was. Campbell hung up without saying another word. After hearing the fury of his senior staff, Scully surveyed the members of the board. They likewise felt that Jobs had misled them with his pledge that he would not raid important employees. Arthur Rock was especially angry. Even though he had sided with Scully during the Memorial Day showdown, he had been able to repair his paternal relationship with Jobs. Just the week before, he had invited Jobs to bring his girlfriend up to San Francisco so that he and his wife could meet her, and the four had a nice dinner in Rock's Pacific Heights home. Jobs had not mentioned the new company he was forming, so Rock felt betrayed when he heard about it from Scully. "He came to the board and lied to us," Rock growled later. "He told us he was thinking of forming a company, when in fact he had already formed it. He said he was going to take a few middle-level people. It turned out to be 5 senior people." Markala, in his subdued way, was also offended. He took some top executives he had secretly lined up before he left. That's not the way you do things. It was ungentlemanly. Over the weekend, both the board and the executive staff convinced Scully that Apple would have to declare war on its co-founder. Markala issued a formal statement accusing Jobs of acting in direct contradiction to his statements that he wouldn't recruit any key Apple personnel for his company. He added ominously, "We are evaluating what possible action should be taken." Campbell was quoted in the Wall Street Journal as saying, "He was stunned and shocked by Jobs' behavior." Jobs had left his meeting with Scully thinking that things might proceed smoothly, so he had kept quiet. But after reading the newspapers, he felt that he had to respond. He phoned a few favored reporters and invited them to his home for private briefings the next day. Then he called Andy Cunningham, who had handled his publicity at Regis McKenna. "I went over to his unfurnished mansion-y place in Woodside," she recalled, "and I found him huddled in the kitchen with his five colleagues and a few reporters hanging outside on the lawn." Jobs told her that he was going to do a full-fledged press conference and started spewing some of the derogatory things he was going to say. Cunningham was appalled. "This is going to reflect badly on you," she told him. Finally, he backed down. He decided that he would give the reporters a copy of the resignation letter and limit any on-the-record comments to a few bland statements. Jobs had considered just mailing in his letter of resignation, but Susan Barnes convinced him that this would be too contemptuous. Instead, he drove it to Markula's house, where he also found Al Eisenstadt. There was a tense conversation for about 15 minutes, then Barnes, who had been waiting outside, came to the door to retrieve him before he said anything he would regret. He left behind the letter, which he had composed on a Macintosh and printed on the new laser writer. September 17, 1985. "Dear Mike, this morning's papers carried suggestions that Apple is considering removing me as chairman. I don't know the source of these reports, but they are both misleading to the public and unfair to me. You will recall that at last Thursday's board meeting, I stated I had decided to start a new venture, and I tendered my resignation as chairman. The board declined to accept my resignation and asked me to defer it for a week. I agreed to do so in light of the encouragement the board offered with regard to the proposed new venture and the indications that Apple would invest in it. On Friday, after I told John Scully who would be joining me, he confirmed Apple's willingness to discuss areas of possible collaboration between Apple and my new venture. Subsequently, the company appears to be adopting a hostile posture toward me in the new venture. Accordingly, I must insist upon the immediate acceptance of my resignation. As you know, the company's recent reorganization left me with no work to do and no access even to regular management reports. I am but 30 and want still to contribute and achieve. After what we have accomplished together, I would wish our parting to be both amicable and dignified. Yours sincerely, Stephen P. Jobs." When a guy from the facilities team went to Jobs' office to pack up his belongings, he saw a picture frame on the floor. It contained a photograph of Jobs and Scully in warm conversation with an inscription from 7 months earlier, "Here's to great ideas, great experiences, and a great friendship, John." The glass frame was shattered. Jobs had hurled it across the room before leaving. From that day, he never spoke to Scully again. Apple's stock went up a full point, or almost 7%, when Jobs' resignation was announced. East Coast stockholders always worried about California flakes running the company, explained the editor of a tech stock newsletter. Now with both Wozniak and Jobs out, those shareholders are relieved. But Nolan Bushnell, the Atari founder who had been an amused mentor 10 years earlier, told Time that Jobs would be badly missed. Where is Apple's inspiration going to come from? Is Apple going to have all the romance of a new brand of Pepsi? After a few days of failed efforts to reach a settlement with Jobs, Scully and the Apple board decided to sue him for breaches of fiduciary obligations. The suit spelled out his alleged transgressions. Notwithstanding his fiduciary obligations to Apple, Jobs, while serving as the chairman of Apple's board of directors and an officer of Apple and pretending loyalty to the interests of Apple, A. secretly planned the formation of an enterprise to compete with Apple, B. secretly schemed that his competing enterprise would wrongfully take advantage of and utilize Apple's plan to design, develop, and market the next generation product, C. Secretly lured away key employees of Apple. At the time, Jobs owned 6.5 million shares of Apple stock, 11% of the company, worth more than $100 million. He began to sell his shares, and within 5 months had dumped them all, retaining only one share so he could attend shareholder meetings if he wanted. He was furious, and that was reflected in his passion to start what was, no matter how he spun it, a rival company. He was angry at Apple, said Joanna Hoffman, who briefly went to work for the new company. Aiming at the educational market, where Apple was strong, was simply Steve being vengeful. He was doing it for revenge. Jobs, of course, didn't see it that way. I haven't got any sort of odd chip on my shoulder, he told Newsweek. Once again, he invited his favorite reporters over to his Woodside home, and this time he did not have Andy Cunningham there urging him to be circumspect. He dismissed the allegation that he had improperly lured the five colleagues from Apple. These people all called me, he told the gaggle of journalists who were milling around in his unfurnished living room. They were thinking of leaving the company. Apple has a way of neglecting people. He decided to cooperate with a Newsweek cover in order to get his version of the story out, and the interview he gave was revealing. What I'm best at doing is finding a group of talented people and making things with them, he told the magazine. He said that he would always harbor affection for Apple. I'll always remember Apple like any man remembers the first woman he's fallen in love with. But he was also willing to fight with its management if need be. When someone calls you a thief in public, you have to respond. Apple's threat to sue him was outrageous. It was also sad. It showed that Apple was no longer a confident, rebellious company. It's hard to think that a $2 billion company with 4,300 employees couldn't compete with six people in blue jeans. To try to counter Jobs' spin, Scully called Wozniak and urged him to speak out. Steve can be an insulting and hurtful guy, he told Time that week. He revealed that Jobs had asked him to join his new firm. It would have been a sly way to land another blow against Apple's current management. But he wanted no part of such games and had not returned Jobs' phone call. To the San Francisco Chronicle, he recounted how Jobs had blocked Frog Design from working on his remote control under the pretense that it might compete with Apple products. I look forward to a great product, and I wish him success. But his integrity, I cannot trust, Wozniak said. To be on your own. The best thing ever to happen to Steve is when we fired him, told him to get lost, Arthur Rock later said. The theory, shared by many, is that the tough love made him wiser and more mature. But it's not that simple. At the company he founded after being ousted from Apple, Jobs was able to indulge all of his instincts, both good and bad. He was unbound. The result was a series of spectacular products that were dazzling market flops. This was the true learning experience. What prepared him for the great success he would have in Act 3 was not his ouster from his Act 1 at Apple, but his brilliant failures in Act 2. The first instinct that he indulged was his passion for design. The name he chose for his new company was rather straightforward, Next. In order to make it more distinctive, he decided he needed a world-class logo. So he courted the dean of corporate logos, Paul Rand. At 71, the Brooklyn-born graphic designer had already created some of the best-known logos in business, including those of Esquire, IBM, Westinghouse, ABC, and UPS. He was under contract to IBM, and his supervisors there said that it would obviously be a conflict for him to create a logo for another computer company. So Jobs picked up the phone and called IBM's CEO, John Akers. Akers was out of town,
But Jobs was so persistent that he was finally put through to Vice Chairman Paul Rizzo. After 2 days, Rizzo concluded that it was futile to resist Jobs, and he gave permission for Rand to do the work. Rand flew out to Palo Alto and spent time walking with Jobs and listening to his vision. The computer would be a cube, Jobs pronounced. He loved that shape. It was perfect and simple. So Rand decided that the logo should be a cube as well, one that was tilted at a 28-degree angle. When Jobs asked for a number of options to consider, Rand declared that he did not create different options for clients. "I will solve your problem, and you will pay me," he told Jobs. "You can use what I produce or not, but I will not do options. And either way, you will pay me." Jobs admired that kind of thinking, so he made what was quite a gamble. The company would pay an astonishing $100,000 flat fee to get one design. "There was a clarity in our relationship," Jobs said. He had a purity as an artist, but he was astute at solving business problems. He had a tough exterior and had perfected the image of a curmudgeon, but he was a teddy bear inside. It was one of Jobs' highest praises, purity as an artist. It took Rand just 2 weeks. He flew back to deliver the result to Jobs at his Woodside house. First, they had dinner. Then Rand handed him an elegant and vibrant booklet that described his thought process. On the final spread, Rand presented the logo he had chosen. In its design, color arrangement, and orientation, the logo is a study in contrasts, his booklet proclaimed. Tipped at a jaunty angle, it brims with the informality, friendliness, and spontaneity of a Christmas seal and the authority of a rubber stamp. The word "next" was split into two lines to fill the square face of the cube, with only the E in lowercase. That letter stood out, Rand's booklet explained, to connote education, excellence, E equals MC squared. It was often hard to predict how Jobs would react to a presentation. He could label it shitty or brilliant. One never knew which way he might go. But with a legendary designer such as Rand, the chances were that Jobs would embrace the proposal. He stared at the final spread, looked up at Rand, and then hugged him. They had one minor disagreement. Rand had used a dark yellow for the E in the logo, and Jobs wanted him to change it to a brighter and more traditional yellow. Rand banged his fist on the table and declared, "I've been doing this for 50 years, and I know what I'm doing." Jobs relented. The company had a new logo. Others might not have understood the need to obsess over a logo, much less pay $100,000 for one, but for Jobs it meant that Next was starting life with a world-class feel and identity, even if it hadn't yet designed its first product. As Markkula had taught him, a great company must be able to impute its values from the first impression it makes. As a bonus, Rand agreed to design for Jobs a personal calling card. He came up with a colorful type treatment, which Jobs liked, but they ended up having a lengthy and heated disagreement about the placement of the period after the P in Stephen P. Jobs. Rand had placed the period to the right of the P, as it would appear if set in lead type. Steve preferred the period to be nudged to the left, under the curve of the P, as is possible with digital typography. It was a fairly large argument about something relatively small, Susan Kerr recalled. On this one, Jobs prevailed. In order to translate the Next logo into the look of real products, Jobs needed an industrial designer he trusted. He talked to a few possibilities, but none of them impressed him as much as the wild Bavarian he had imported to Apple, Hartmut Esslinger, whose frog design had set up shop in Silicon Valley, and who, thanks to Jobs, had a lucrative contract with Apple. Getting IBM to permit Paul Rand to do work for Next was a small miracle
willed into existence by Jobs' belief that reality can be distorted. But that was a snap compared to the likelihood that he could convince Apple to permit Esslinger to work for Next. This did not keep Jobs from trying. At the beginning of November 1985, just 5 weeks after Apple filed suit against him, Jobs wrote Eisenstadt and asked for dispensation. "I spoke with Hartmut Esslinger this weekend, and he suggested I write you a note expressing why I wish to work with him and Frog Design on the new products for Next," he said. Astonishingly, Jobs's argument was that he did not know what Apple had in the works, but Esslinger did. "Next has no knowledge as to the current or future directions of Apple's product designs, nor do other design firms we might deal with. So it is possible to inadvertently design similar-looking products. It is in both Apple's and Next's best interest to rely on Hartmut's professionalism to make sure this does not occur." Eisenstadt recalled being flabbergasted by Jobs's audacity, and he replied curtly, "I have previously expressed my concern on behalf of Apple that you are engaged in a business course which involves your utilization of Apple's confidential business information," he wrote. "Your letter does not alleviate my concern in any way. In fact, it heightens my concern because it states that you have no knowledge as to the current or future directions of Apple's product designs, a statement which is not true." What made the request all the more astonishing to Eisenstadt was that it was Jobs who, just a year earlier, had forced Frog Design to abandon its work on Wozniak's remote control device. Jobs realized that in order to work with Esslinger, and for a variety of other reasons, it would be necessary to resolve the lawsuit that Apple had filed. Fortunately, Scully was willing. In January 1986, they reached an out-of-court agreement involving no financial damages. In return for Apple dropping its suit, Next agreed to a variety of restrictions. Its product would be marketed as a high-end workstation, it would be sold directly to colleges and universities, and it would not ship before March 1987. Apple also insisted that the Next machine not use an operating system compatible with a Macintosh, though it could be argued that Apple would have been better served by insisting on just the opposite. After the settlement, Jobs continued to court Esslinger until the designer decided to wind down his contract with Apple. That allowed Frog Design to work with Next at the end of 1986. Esslinger insisted on having free rein, just as Paul Rand had. "Sometimes you have to use a big stick with Steve," he said. Like Rand, Esslinger was an artist, so Jobs was willing to grant him indulgences he denied other mortals. Jobs decreed that the computer should be an absolutely perfect cube, with each side exactly a foot long and every angle precisely 90 degrees. He liked cubes. They had gravitas, but also the slight whiff of a toy. But the Next cube was a Jobsian example of design desires trumping engineering considerations. The circuit boards, which fit nicely into the traditional pizza box shape, had to be reconfigured and stacked in order to nestle into a cube. Even worse, the perfection of the cube made it hard to manufacture. Most parts that are cast in molds have angles that are slightly greater than pure 90 degrees, so that it's easier to get them out of the mold, just as it is easier to get a cake out of a pan that has angles slightly greater than 90 degrees. But Esslinger dictated, and Jobs enthusiastically agreed, that there would be no such draft angles that would ruin the purity and perfection of the cube. So the sides had to be produced separately, using molds that cost $650,000 at a specialty machine shop in Chicago. Jobs's passion for perfection was out of control. When he noticed a tiny line in the chassis caused by the molds, something that any other computer maker would accept as unavoidable, he flew to Chicago and convinced the die caster to start over and do it perfectly.
Not a lot of die-casters expect a celebrity to fly in, noted one of the engineers. Jobs also had the company buy a $150,000 sanding machine to remove all lines where the mold faces met and insisted that the magnesium case be a matte black, which made it more susceptible to showing blemishes. Jobs had always indulged his obsession that the unseen parts of a product should be crafted as beautifully as its facade, just as his father had taught him when they were building a fence. This, too, he took to extremes when he found himself unfettered at Next. He made sure that the screws inside the machine had expensive plating. He even insisted that the matte black finish be coated onto the inside of the cube's case, even though only repairmen would see it. Joe Nocera, then writing for Esquire, captured Jobs' intensity at a Next staff meeting. It's not quite right to say that he is sitting through this staff meeting, because Jobs doesn't sit through much of anything. One of the ways he dominates is through sheer movement. One moment he's kneeling in his chair, the next minute he's slouching in it, the next he has leaped out of his chair entirely and is scribbling on the blackboard directly behind him. He is full of mannerisms. He bites his nails. He stares with unnerving earnestness at whoever is speaking. His hands, which are slightly and inexplicably yellow, are in constant motion. What particularly struck Nocera was Jobs's almost willful lack of tact. It was more than just an inability to hide his opinions when others said something he thought dumb. It was a conscious readiness, even a perverse eagerness, to put people down, humiliate them, show he was smarter. When Daniel Lewin handed out an organization chart, for example, Jobs rolled his eyes. "These charts are bullshit," he interjected. Yet his mood still swung wildly, as at Apple. A finance person came into the meeting, and Jobs lavished praise on him for a really, really great job on this. The previous day, Jobs had told him, "This deal is crap." One of Next's first 10 employees was an interior designer for the company's first headquarters in Palo Alto. Even though Jobs had leased a building that was new and nicely designed, he had it completely gutted and rebuilt. Walls were replaced by glass. The carpets were replaced by light hardwood flooring. The process was repeated when Next moved to a bigger space in Redwood City in 1989. Even though the building was brand new, Jobs insisted that the elevators be moved so that the entrance lobby would be more dramatic. As a centerpiece, Jobs commissioned I.M. Pei to design a grand staircase that seemed to float in the air. The contractor said it couldn't be built. Jobs said it could, and it was. Years later, Jobs would make such staircases a feature at Apple's signature stores. The computer. During the early months of Next, Jobs and Daniel Lewin went on the road, often accompanied by a few colleagues, to visit campuses and solicit opinions. At Harvard, they met with Mitch Kapoor, the chairman of Lotus Software, over dinner at Harvest Restaurant. When Kapoor began slathering butter on his bread, Jobs asked him, "Have you ever heard of serum cholesterol?" Kapoor responded, "I'll make you a deal. You stay away from commenting on my dietary habits, and I will stay away from the subject of your personality." It was meant humorously, but as Kapoor later commented, human relationships were not his strong suit. Lotus agreed to write a spreadsheet program for the Next operating system. Jobs wanted to bundle useful content with the machine. So Michael Hawley, one of the engineers, developed a digital dictionary. He learned that a friend of his at Oxford University Press had been involved in the typesetting of a new edition of Shakespeare's works. That meant that there was probably a computer tape he could get his hands on, and if so, incorporate it into the Next's memory. "So I called up Steve, and he said that would be awesome, and we flew over to Oxford together."
On a beautiful spring day in 1986, they met in the publishing house's grand building in the heart of Oxford, where Jobs made an offer of $2,000 plus 74 cents for every computer sold in order to have the rights to Oxford's edition of Shakespeare. "It will be all gravy to you," he argued. "You will be ahead of the parade. It's never been done before." They agreed in principle, and then went out to play skittles over beer at a nearby pub where Lord Byron used to drink. By the time it launched, the next would also include a dictionary, a thesaurus, and the Oxford Dictionary of Quotations, making it one of the pioneers of the concept of searchable electronic books. Instead of using off-the-shelf chips for the next, Jobs had his engineers design custom ones that integrated a variety of functions on one chip. That would have been hard enough, but Jobs made it almost impossible by continually revising the functions he wanted it to do. After a year, it became clear that this would be a major source of delay. He also insisted on building his own fully automated and futuristic factory, just as he had for the Macintosh. He had not been chastened by that experience. This time, too, he made the same mistakes, only more excessively. Machines and robots were painted and repainted as he compulsively revised his color scheme. The walls were museum white, as they had been at the Macintosh factory, and there were $20,000 black leather chairs and a custom-made staircase, just as in the corporate headquarters. He insisted that the machinery on the 165-foot assembly line be configured to move the circuit boards from right to left as they got built, so that the process would look better to visitors who watched from the viewing gallery. Empty circuit boards were fed in at one end, and 20 minutes later, untouched by humans, came out the other end as completed boards. The process followed the Japanese principle known as Kanban, in which each machine performs its task only when the next machine is ready to receive another part. Jobs had not tempered his way of dealing with employees. He applied charm or public humiliation in a way that in most cases proved to be pretty effective, Tribble recalled, but sometimes it wasn't. One engineer, David Paulson, put in 90-hour weeks for the first 10 months at Next. He quit when Steve walked in one Friday afternoon and told us how unimpressed he was with what we were doing. When Business Week asked him why he treated employees so harshly, Jobs said it made the company better. "Part of my responsibility is to be a yardstick of quality. Some people aren't used to an environment where excellence is expected." But he still had his spirit and charisma. There were plenty of field trips, visits by Aikido masters, and off-site retreats. And he still exuded the pirate flag spunkiness. When Apple fired Shiat Day, the ad firm that had done the 1984 ad and taken out the newspaper ad saying, "Welcome, IBM, seriously," Jobs took out a full-page ad in the Wall Street Journal proclaiming, "Congratulations, Shiat Day, seriously, because I can guarantee you, there is life after Apple." Perhaps the greatest similarity to his days at Apple was that Jobs brought with him his reality distortion field. It was on display at the company's first retreat at Pebble Beach in late 1985. There, Jobs pronounced that the first Next computer would be shipped in just 18 months. It was already clear that this date was impossible, but he blew off a suggestion from one engineer that they be realistic and plan on shipping in 1988. "If we do that, the world isn't standing still. The technology window passes us by, and all the work we've done, we have to throw down the toilet," he argued. Joanna Hoffman, the veteran of the Macintosh team who was among those willing to challenge Jobs, did so. "Reality distortion has motivational value, and I think that's fine," she said as Jobs stood at a whiteboard. "However, when it comes to setting a date in a way that affects the design of the product, then we get into real deep shit. Jobs didn't agree. I think we have to drive a stake in the ground somewhere, and I think if we miss this window, then our credibility starts to erode. What he did not say, even though it was suspected by all, was that if their targets slipped, they might run out of money. Jobs had pledged $7 million of his own funds, but at their current burn rate, they would run out in 18 months if they didn't start getting some revenue from shipped products. 3 months later, when they returned to Pebble Beach for their next retreat, Jobs began his list of maxims with, "The honeymoon is over." By the time of the third retreat in Sonoma in September 1986, the timetable was gone, and it looked as though the company would hit a financial wall. Perot to the rescue. In late 1986, Jobs sent out a proposal to venture capital firms offering a 10% stake in Next for $3 million. That put a valuation on the entire company of $30 million, a number that Jobs had pulled out of thin air. Less than $7 million had gone into the company thus far, and there was little to show for it other than a neat logo and some snazzy offices. It had no revenue or products, and none on the horizon. Not surprisingly, the venture capitalists all passed on the offer to invest. There was, however, one cowboy who was dazzled. Ross Perot, the bantam Texan who had founded Electronic Data Systems and then sold it to General Motors for $2.4 billion, happened to watch a PBS documentary, The Entrepreneurs, which had a segment on Jobs and Next in November 1986. He instantly identified with Jobs and his gang, so much so that as he watched them on television, he said, "I was finishing their sentences for them." It was a line eerily similar to one Scully had often used. Perot called Jobs the next day and offered, "If you ever need an investor, call me." Jobs did indeed need one, badly. But he was careful not to show it. He waited a week before calling back. Perot sent some of his analysts to size up Next, but Jobs took care to deal directly with Perot. One of his great regrets in life, Perot later said, was that he had not bought Microsoft, or a large stake in it, when a very young Bill Gates had come to visit him in Dallas in 1979. By the time Perot called Jobs, Microsoft had just gone public with a $1 billion valuation. Perot had missed out on the opportunity to make a lot of money and have a fun adventure. He was eager not to make that mistake again. Jobs made an offer to Perot that was three times more costly than had quietly been offered to venture capitalists a few months earlier. For $20 million, Perot would get 16% of the equity in the company after Jobs put in another $5 million. That meant the company would be valued at about $126 million. But money was not a major consideration for Perot. After a meeting with Jobs, he declared that he was in. "I pick the jockeys, and the jockeys pick the horses and ride them," he told Jobs. "You guys are the ones I'm betting on, so you figure it out." Perot brought to Next something that was almost as valuable as his $20 million lifeline. He was a quotable, spirited cheerleader for the company, who could lend it an air of credibility among grown-ups. "In terms of a startup company, it's one that carries the least risk of any I've seen in 25 years in the computer industry," he told the New York Times. "We've had some sophisticated people see the hardware. It blew them away. Steve and his whole Next team are the darndest bunch of perfectionists I've ever seen." Perot also traveled in rarefied social and business circles that complemented Jobs' own. He took Jobs to a black tie dinner dance in San Francisco that Gordon and Ann Getty gave for King Juan Carlos I of Spain. When the king asked Perot whom he should meet, Perot immediately produced Jobs. They were soon engaged in what Perot later described as electric conversation, with Jobs animatedly describing the next wave in computing. At the end, the king scribbled a note and handed it to Jobs. "What happened?" Perot asked. Jobs answered, "I sold him a computer." These and other stories were incorporated into the mythologized story of Jobs that Perot told wherever he went. At a briefing at the National Press Club in Washington, he spun Jobs's life story into a Texas-sized yarn about a young man so poor he couldn't afford to go to college, working in his garage at night, playing with computer chips, which was his hobby, and his dad, who looks like a character out of a Norman Rockwell painting, comes in one day and said, "Steve, either make something you can sell or go get a job." 60 days later, in a wooden box that his dad made for him, the first Apple computer was created, and this high school graduate literally changed the world. The one phrase that was true was the one about Paul Jobs's looking like someone in a Rockwell painting. And perhaps the last phrase, the one about Jobs changing the world. Certainly Perot believed that. Like Scully, he saw himself in Jobs. "Steve's like me," Perot told the Washington Post's David Remnick. "We're weird in the same way. We're soulmates." Gates and Next. Bill Gates was not a soulmate. Jobs had convinced him to produce software applications for the Macintosh, which had turned out to be hugely profitable for Microsoft. But Gates was one person who was resistant to Jobs' reality distortion field, and as a result, he decided not to create software tailored for the next platform. Gates went to California to get periodic demonstrations, but each time he came away unimpressed. The Macintosh was truly unique, "but I personally don't understand what is so unique about Steve's new computer," he told Fortune. Part of the problem was that the rival titans were congenitally unable to be deferential to each other. When Gates made his first visit to Next's Palo Alto headquarters in the summer of 1987, Jobs kept him waiting for a half hour in the lobby. Even though Gates could see through the glass walls that Jobs was walking around having casual conversations. "I'd gone down to Next and I had the Odwalla, the most expensive carrot juice, and I'd never seen tech offices so lavish," Gates recalled, shaking his head with just a hint of a smile. "And Steve comes a half hour late to the meeting." Jobs's sales pitch, according to Gates, was simple. "We did the Mac together," Jobs said. "How did that work for you?" "Very well. Now we're going to do this together, and this is going to be great." But Gates was brutal to Jobs, just as Jobs could be to others. "This machine is crap," he said. "The optical disc has too low latency. The fucking case is too expensive. This thing is ridiculous." He decided then, and reaffirmed on each subsequent visit, that it made no sense for Microsoft to divert resources from other projects to develop applications for Next. Worse yet, he repeatedly said so publicly, which made others less likely to spend time developing for Next. "Develop for it? I'll piss on it," he told InfoWorld. When they happened to meet in the hallway at a conference, Jobs started berating Gates for his refusal to do software for Next. "When you get a market, I will consider it," Gates replied. Jobs got angry. "It was a screaming battle right in front of everybody," recalled Adele Goldberg, the Xerox PARC engineer. Jobs insisted that Next was the next wave of computing. Gates, as he often did, got more expressionless as Jobs got more heated. He finally just shook his head and walked away. Beneath their personal rivalry and occasional grudging respect was their basic philosophical difference. Jobs believed in an end-to-end integration of hardware and software, which led him to build a machine that was not compatible with others. Gates believed in, and profited from, a world in which different companies made machines that were compatible with one another.
Their hardware ran a standard operating system, Microsoft's Windows, and could all use the same software apps, such as Microsoft's Word and Excel. His product comes with an interesting feature called incompatibility, Gates told the Washington Post. It doesn't run any of the existing software. It's a super nice computer,